ideas and new technology are causing seismic shifts in the media industry. Where are we headed? What does it mean? Keep listening. Media strategist Gabriella Mirabelli talks with the brightest minds in entertainment and business. Meet the innovators, the risk takers, and the disruptors on the front lines of change from Hollywood, Wall Street, Silicon Valley, and beyond. The future is coming to a screen near you. Are you ready? This is the Up Next podcast with Gabriella Mirabelli.
Welcome to Up Next. I'm your host, Gabriella Mirabelli. Today, I'm interviewing Marcelino Alvarez, a pioneer in the field of product design and development. This Duke University grad was one of the first integrative interactive producers at Crispin, Porter, and Boguski, where he produced award-winning digital campaigns for VW, Coke Zero, Virgin Atlantic, and Mini USA. As executive interactive producer at Wieden Kennedy, he worked on the Nike Chalkbot, a compassionate robot that delivered positive messages during the Tour de France of 2009 and 2010. He's now the founder and CEO of Uncork Studios, a product design and development firm focused on social impact products. Most recently, he co-founded Incubate, a program that connects and fosters creative exchange between Cuban and American entrepreneurs. Marcelino, thank you so much for joining us today. There's a wealth of things we can talk about because you have such broad experience. And so I'm going to jump a bit from topic to topic. Is it chatbot or a chalkbot? What was it?
Yeah, the Nike Chalkbot.
Chalkbot, sorry. Yeah. It was really fantastic. I saw a video and amazing. But for people who aren't aware of precisely what it was, could you give listeners just the elevator ride description?
Sure, absolutely. Among the many phenomenal traditions of the Tour de France is one where the citizens of local towns that the tour passes through, they'll write messages of inspiration for the cyclists. And in 2009, Nike and the Livestrong Foundation wanted to find a way to bring some of that history and tradition to people who didn't have access to the stages of the tour. And so for that event, as part of an advertising campaign for Wieden Kennedy, which is Nike's advertising agency, we created the Nike Chalkbot, which was a mechanical street printer that would print messages of hope and inspiration all along the tour that would be seen by the cyclists and people and spectators at the event, as well as people who watched the tour back at home on TV.
You know, what was amazing when I saw the YouTube video was that the comments and making the ephemeral real and concrete and durable on the road and bringing participation to a live event, it really felt like this precursor to live group chat, where you'll see, on Facebook, when you'll see the hearts floating across or the thumbs up floating across when somebody's live broadcasting. And it really felt like the earliest stage of that kind of thing. It was really interesting to see. I hadn't been aware of it before. How did your work on the Chalkbot inspire you to start Uncork Studios?
Sure. So a number of things. So when we finished the Nike Chalkbot, I'd recognize this is one of the most amazing things that I'd ever worked on. And I also recognized it was probably the coolest advertising project I'd ever worked on, and that I'd probably spend the rest of my career, if I'd stayed in advertising, searching for that moment where technology combined with the stage of an amazing event with a great cause came together for something that was bigger than ourselves. And I recognized that I could either, you know, spend the rest of my career chasing that or really start a company that could find a way to bring together incredible designers, engineers, and producers to create products that have a bigger and broader purpose. And so that was really the genesis of Uncork, saying how can we, you know, build products with purpose and carry that spirit of putting our efforts to good use beyond advertising.
So who are your clients? Are they brands? Are they agencies? Are they municipalities? Who are you selling your services to?
So we've been fortunate to work with a number of organizations and different types of clients. And I think we've kind of realized along the way we're not really good at selling things. And so we find ourselves in conversations with potential partners on projects to really understand how can we, you know, put our skills to good use. So, sometimes that's meant, you know, creating interconnected devices for, you know, Fortune 100 companies. And in other cases, that's working with nonprofits. We once accidentally started a nonprofit. And more recently, we've been working with a group to connect entrepreneurs in the U.S. and other countries such as Cuba, Israel, Palestine, Lebanon, and Myanmar. And that's a little bit of a squishy answer, but more specifically, you know, we've partnered with companies like Adidas, Google, and Intel on a variety of products for, you know, different groups within the organizations, R&D teams, future-facing teams, groups that are developing, you know, new IoT technology and want to find proof cases for how, you know, low-powered chips might be rolled out into inventory tracking technology. We've also been working with a group that was born out of the Aspen Institute called Fringe Diplomacy that's seeking to connect entrepreneurs here in the U.S. With their counterparts abroad. And so I think if you look at what we really do well, it's really the sum of all those parts, being able to build a connected device one day and being able to help a nonprofit like the Magnum Foundation tell stories of Arab photographers the next day. And it's the whole of that that really makes Uncorked a unique place. We're not a B Corp. We're not a nonprofit. We don't only do work for nonprofits, but we recognize that, you know, our time working on a thing, whatever that thing is pretty precious. And so we want whatever that thing is to be something that really creates real and lasting value in the world.
So are people seeking you out then, that they know about a previous project you've done and then they seek you out to help them? And are you, when you say you're creating the product, is it an actual like a consumer product or is it something different?
Yes, people seek us out. It's funny. One of the earliest projects we worked on was a stop motion movie making app for Lego, the toy brand. And that one app that we did must have been now like 5 years ago has led to more inquiries about who we are and what we do than I think anything else we've ever done, which is pretty neat. But we've also found ourselves, you know, kind of attending events or meeting people that then just kind of leads to the organic conversation of like, well, wait, what do you guys do? And similar, you know, what do you build it? When you say products, what do you mean? That means something different to you know, different organizations. And the answer is, you know, in some cases, it's as simple as a website or a mobile application. In other cases, we're, you know, developing hardware, the industrial design and kind of the end-to-end consumer experience for a physical product. One of our most recent clients was Google's Brand Lab, and we developed a wall. The brief was, we have this wall. What should we do with this wall? Text of what we do in this group. How could we, you know, use this wall as kind of a hero moment for the people that we bring into this space? And so, you know, open-ended questions like that are fascinating for us because it gives us an opportunity to mix, you know, our conceptual chops with, you know, our engineering skills and our design leadership to really build something unique. And in the case of some of those clients, it is a physical, you know, consumer product. Sometimes it's just a purely digital one. And you know, sometimes it's just a better way to kind of message or brand the story of the thing that you're building.
Right. Now, since you launched your company, that was 6 years ago, and it sort of creates these experiences and then bridges the divide between the physical and the brands and the people, there's been accelerating change in the digital space and landscape. And how has that change, you know, which has been really disruptive to media companies and content companies, how has that disrupted your business, helped your business, affected your business? How has it changed what you've done?
Sure. It's a good question. I think part of it, you know, mobile application design and development became very quickly commoditized in the last few years. And so I think in the very early beginnings of Uncorked, people would come to us and say, hey, what should our mobile strategy be? We are in this space. We know we need to be in this space, or we want to move into this space. And here's who we are and what we're trying to do. And so it was much more of an open-ended question than what it became, which was, hey, I mocked up this app. Can you build this app? Just do this. And that became less interesting for us because at that point, you know, some of the unique questions of, well, what's the best platform for this, or what are the right design choices that solve, you know, a particular business problem or design problem have either, you know, been solved correctly or incorrectly. But it's difficult once those decisions have been made to kind of go back and really look at the entire product a bit more holistically. Right. So we made a strategic decision a few years ago to start moving into the, you know, Internet of Things, IoT space. And I'm not a big buzzword person, so I actually hate the word IoT, but nothing better has come along. You know, the idea that all our devices and our environments are becoming connected, and with, you know, greater awareness of where we are, when we are there, and how we're interacting with that space, our mobile applications, the sensors, the smart home products, they all need to come together to create a cohesive experience. Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, one of the ways that we've benefited from this is just saying, look, let's look at the entire environment in particular, not just be a digital shop that makes apps, but, you know, we've brought in industrial designers and hardware engineers, people that, you know, had been at Intel for 15 years, you know, are now members of our team, so that we can look at that, you know, environment of, you know, a blank wall and say, well, what really makes sense for this particular, you know, moment in time, for this particular brand, and come up with an idea. And I think, you know, eventually some of the sensors and the hardware chips, they'll also get commoditized, and people will come to us and say, hey, I've got all these sensors deployed. What should I do with it? Or here's what I want to do with it. But for now, I think it's still kind of in the early going. And I think the near future is going to have a lot of moments where the technology and the hype of IoT gets in the way of itself. And I think, you know, for us, as long as we can stay true to our mission of building things that solve real problems, I think we'll be able to avoid some of the early commoditization. I don't know where it goes from, you know, from IoT. I'm not as bullish on VR and AR as a lot of other people are. I think it's an interesting space, and I think there's an amazing storytelling opportunity with VR. Mm. But I'm not entirely convinced that we're going to be walking around their offices with, you know, a piece of glass, you know, hovering 6 inches from our face and having light projected onto it, because at the end of the day, we're still humans. And I think there'll be moments where that makes sense. And I look forward to being able to design those moments. But I think we're still pretty skeptical on, you know, how pervasive that's going to be in the living room, or how pervasive it's going to be, you know, in the workplace, outside of places where, you know, it absolutely makes sense. If you're playing video games, well, then VR and AR make sense. If you're, you know, doing entertainment, you know, at an amusement park, then you can control for it. Maybe it makes sense, but it's still a little bit of hype ahead of, you know, I would say both AR, VR, and even to a lesser extent, IoT. I think we need to get past kind of the availability of low powered chips and connecting them to LED bulbs and offer legitimate value that helps us do the things that we want to be doing. But I guess that's a very long answer to your question. But
well, lots of different places. There's sort of things to jump in. I mean, context obviously really matters, you know, for all of these things. If you're talking AR, VR, to your point, like the context, and is it the right thing for the context? I mean, one of the things about the Internet of Things, which I find a little, I don't know, I worry that it's going to turn into, like, you know how clocks are on every appliance you own, and why do you have a calendar on your microwave? I don't know. It's just there. And so I worry about, just because you can, people do. And I don't know that that's necessarily what we want. And so you're at a great place where you can hopefully steer things to be, to your point, answer a problem or solve a problem, rather than just do it because look at the whiz bang we can, you know? So one of the things that's important for content companies that I'm dealing with is discoverability and how people find the content. And with the stuff that, when you're putting it together, are you ever concerned with the target audience that you're trying to reach, or is that discoverability piece sort of always taken care of by your client?
That's a good question. I think in many cases, our clients have the mechanisms to promote the products that we're building. That's not to say that we're not part of some of those early kind of strategic conversations, understanding, you know, what is the right audience that this should be communicated to, and how should we develop or design, you know, for them. I think there's, you know, especially with the projects that maybe don't have, you know, an entire marketing team or brand, you know, communications team behind them, I think there's definitely challenges to discoverability. And so I think in some of those, we work with our clients and partners to really understand, you know, who are the networks of people that are worth connecting to for this, who can be evangelists for the type of work that you're doing, and reach out to them to help them kind of promote. So I think, you know, and by and large, I think this is probably applicable in a number of areas for Uncork. We can be scrappy when we need to be, and we can augment or complement the existing resources that our clients have when they do have them. So it's a mixed bag, I would say. I would say in some cases we certainly need to you know, think through how we do, you know, influencer outreach and reach, you know, whether it's investors or donors or potential, you know, delegates for some of these, you know, future diplomatic trips. Those types of programs, I think, require us to think through, you know, a communications content plan, how we're telling the story and the value proposition of what we're offering and how that's differentiated from, you know, other industries or businesses in the space.
Right. One of the things that agencies and marketing and promotion firms and networks are more and more they're learning, leaning on data and big data, small data, data science. How much does data drive what you do? Is that piece done by the client before they get to you, or is that something that you bring to the party for the client, or is it six one, half dozen the other? I mean, how does data work with you?
Sure. How does data work with me? That's a great question. In some cases, there's a bit of initial research that our clients do that indicate that they have a hypothesis of a particular audience that they want to reach or a particular gap in the marketplace for a product. And so what we'll try to do either qualitatively or quantitatively is to validate that hypothesis. So is this a product that, you know, someone in the 18 to 24 demographic is really going to use? How can we do some research to understand the pain points, the needs, and validate what they think is true? And in a lot of the cases with IoT products, the devices or the systems that we're building have the opportunity to capture quite a bit of data. And so it's on us to build a system that can not only capture that data, but we can build intelligent models to understand things like recommendation engines or taste profiles or, you know, activity or athletic, you know, recommendations for a particular feature set that consumers might be demanding in a product. So I would say it's a mix. I would say, you know, we're not a data science firm that is just looking, you know, through behavioral insights and spreadsheets to try to make sense of what the next, you know, hot holiday item is going to be. But I think we have a number of individuals whose backgrounds in either academia or in research allow us to look through existing data and research intelligently and model products that are able to capture sufficient data to learn from how people are using them. What is being used, what isn't being used, and how to then build additional features that are customized to individual consumers' needs that can kind of be modeled against trends or modeled against actual, you know, application or device usage over time.
Right. One of the things, I mean, this is sort of circling, I guess, back again to the Internet of Things is and data and data collection is privacy. And where do you feel, when you're constructing some of these things, especially Internet of Things things, where do you feel that line should be drawn? I mean, with privacy and, you know, convenience, and it's a corporate, you know, I don't know, your refrigerator and who knows what you're buying and how porous are these things? And does that even, is that part of what you're thinking about when you're putting it together?
It's certainly a part of what we're thinking when we're putting it together. I mean, I think, you know, I would say privacy and security are both critical issues with IoT. And if you look at the ecosystem of the types of startups that are emerging, a lot of them are very focused on the consumer, focused on, you know, kind of solving one small part of the problem, but they don't look at the entire, you know, ecosystem to understand where weaknesses might exist. So, you know, I think if you look at devices that can be hacked, you know, through some sort of security flaw, that's a concern that exists. I think if you look at how a consumer is alerted to what is the data that is being captured and how is it being used, and what are the design mechanisms by which we allow our consumers to really make intelligent decisions about, you know, what's being tracked over time. On some level, knowing what's in my fridge could be incredibly convenient so that I don't have to, you know, reorder things or go to the grocery store. But if that's somehow being used, you know, elsewhere to kind of create, you know, some, you know, devious profile of
broccoli eaters.
Yes. Yeah. More likely to, you know, rob a bank if you eat this much broccoli. You know, things like that, I think, you know, taken out of context, you know, I should have a better understanding and be able to opt in and out of these things. I might want to trade privacy for convenience. But that changes when you have, you know, young children in the home.
Right. Can one, if you have a shared resource like a refrigerator, can one person opt for an entire family? And if there are minors, can you opt for them? And at what point? I mean, in Europe, there is a tendency, I think, to opt in to sharing information. And in America, you need to opt out typically. So I think it's an interesting conundrum. I just was wondering if that's is that something that you're even able, is it part of your purview, that sort of some of these security concerns?
It is on some level. So when we're a system that is capturing data, and we did some work with a client a number of years ago that, you know, it's a fine line between convenient and creepy. It's a very fine line. And it was a product that had a lot of value for a particular demographic that could use technology later in life to increase mobility and freedom and independence. But at the same time, that same data, if abused or presented in a different way, could have a very different tone. So much of it is onboarding, is the lost art of explaining to someone how you're going to use their data and what to expect next. And I think if you look at just the design of onboarding screens or systems for a lot of these products, that's an opportunity, you know, not just to opt in or out, but to create that bridge of trust with the consumer to say, look, here's what I'm collecting from you. Here's why I need this. Here's how this makes our interaction, our relationship better over time. If at any given point in time you change your mind about these things, here's where you need to look in the app or in the setup of, you know, screen on your hub to turn this off. We'll remind you periodically because we know you're busy and you might not remember this. So we'll once a year, once a quarter, ping you to say, here's what we're collecting. Here's how we're using it. Let us know if you have any questions. I think if half of our mobile and Internet of Things products had an honest setup experience that explained that, then people would be more likely to trust it and would probably opt into more things. But the fact of the matter is that, you know, the law and the privacy terms and the legalese isn't keeping up with the design. You know, it's probably one of the last things that a product owner looks at when they're working on their startup is like, oh, what should that setup screen be? And so it gets deprioritized. But I think if you design outward from that screen to say, this is the first interaction point that our consumer has with our product, we need to be able to build not just a momentary trust so that they check the box, but like a trust that lasts as long as we expect to be building this product. I think you'd have better products. And I think ultimately people would demand more of it from the other products. I think it would help the entire ecosystem.
Very interesting. Now, switching gears, because we're running tight on time, this fall you launched Incubate Cuba. So can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure, absolutely. So this is part of the diplomatic work that we were doing with the fringe diplomacy. So the backstory to this is a group at the Aspen Institute and the Richardson Center for Global Engagement that set up these fringe diplomatic trips run by a gentleman named Mickey Bergman, who is one of the most amazing people I've ever met, has a heart as big as anyone I've ever met. And Mickey's mission is to connect entrepreneurs, business leaders, creatives, thinkers in the U.S. with their counterparts all around the world. We had a mutual friend that had gone on one of these trips to Cuba in July of 2015, Mara Abrams, and she came back and said, you know, we really need something that can dig a little bit deeper beyond just connecting people. What if we did a design thinking workshop between Cuban entrepreneur and the American counterparts? And so from there, it was kind of the idea of Incubate was born. And so what it is, it's just a two-day workshop that we do as part of the broader fringe diplomacy trip to Cuba, where we sit down with Cuban entrepreneurs, some that are in the tech sector, others that are in sustainability, some are in hospitality, they've got restaurants, and we just share tools and frameworks and align on the problems that any small businesses face today, whether it's, you know, going about hiring employees, scaling a company, designing restaurant menus, to understanding, you know, the difference between a marketing team and a sales team, and what are some of the challenges that, you know, companies face, and what are some of the tools and frameworks that we can use to solve and help us think through those problems. We've been very careful in our messaging and both messaging and actions, you know, to make sure that it's not, you know, here's how American startups approach scaling a $1 billion unicorn, and really more about, look, we're all people. We're all trying to run businesses, and there's certain universal truths, regardless of who's, you know, running a government, who's you know, who's in power, who's in, you know, in control, and there's just universal truths that we all face. So let's share tools and frameworks and adapt to solve our needs, and let's learn from each other. And we've done it now three times in Cuba. Our next trip is coming up in May of next year, and it's an amazing opportunity, I think, just to you know, see an entire, you know, cohort of designers and engineers and developers looking to build, you know, a set of tools and products that solve real problems. And I think, you know, it's kind of wild. You know, I grew up in Miami and you know, now I'm in Portland, but I feel more closer to Cuba living in Portland than I ever did when I was in Miami. And I think part of that is there's a lot of shared values between the way that Portlanders look at startups and companies and building products and the way that some of the startups in Cuba are going about solving the same things. You know, we're not interested in, you know, what Silicon Valley is doing. We want to solve problems that are unique to us, and we want to build companies the way that we want to do it, you know, that aligns with you know, kind of our civic minded, you know, value system of being in Portland. And I think a lot of the startups that we met with in Cuba shared those values and shared those insights. So it's been really tremendous, hoping to, you know, kind of build upon our early successes and dig deeper. You know, with 2 days, there's only so much push. We want to build continuity in our programming and kind of our outreach efforts, but it's been pretty fun.
That's fantastic. I mean, I think it's really also diversity. And so you're getting, it works that the entrepreneurs who are on the Portland side of things are also being enriched by this other input and way of thinking. Yes, it works both ways. It's not just, you know, the sort of the Americans are coming in, right? No,
absolutely. I mean, it's a shared experience. I mean, we learn from the problems they're trying to solve. They learn from the problems we're trying to solve. You know, we talk about, you know, the obvious elephants in the room, and we say we acknowledge that things like the embargo exist, but we're going to ignore them, you know, for the next day and a half as we look at how, you know, a shared vision for how we might collaborate, and that, you know, creates mutual alignment and empathy between two sides, and it's less about the past and more about a shared future. And absolutely everyone learns from it, and everyone comes back on either side of it and says, well, where do we go from here? You know, how do we continue this and keep building on it? So absolutely, it's definitely an experience where both sides learn you know, continue to build.
That's fascinating. Thank you so much. I mean, we've actually run through the time. I really appreciate that you talked to us. I think what you're doing is really interesting. I think the Internet of Things is both scary and interesting for me. I don't know how I feel about how it all shakes out. It's been a pleasure.
Likewise. Thank you so much.
We've reached the end of our episode, and I'd like to close by thanking a few important people who have helped bring the program to life. First, my friend Rob Naughton, the amazing voice artist who recorded our open, and of course, thanks to my production team over at Microfame Media, and a big thank you to our guest, Marcelino Alvarez. And of course, most importantly, all of you, the members of our amazing audience, thank you. I'll be talking to you again next week right here on Up Next.